Scott Spears back with you here on this Wednesday, August the 7th, 2019, 15 minutes past the hour. You're tuned into the early show and hope you're having a great time. Now, this hour is going to be a lot of fun. Now, let me explain a little something to you. We've had a lot of great guests on this program as of late. People getting up early with us live and having phone conversations and learning together. Monday, we had legendary talk show host Phil Donahue, who does not do interviews very often. Phil was very kind and gave us 90 minutes on Monday. We had a longtime guest on the Johnny Carson Tonight Show and many other talk shows, the amazing Kreskin, last Friday. And those are all great, and I love guests like that, and it's always fun to talk with those people. But let me tell you what has happened in the last couple days since we announced that the guest we're going to be joined by this hour was going to be on the show today. I was approached in the grocery store last night by somebody who said, "Hey, I heard you were having Gary Burbank on tomorrow. I've got to make a point to listen to that." And they pulled out their cell phone and made it a point to listen to this program today. I also woke up this morning and saw that somebody was on Facebook and had tagged me in a post. The tag was Gary Burbank on the early show this morning, 8 to 9 a.m. live. You don't want to miss that. Hey, spreads over into the internet. Yesterday, we had somebody come in and pick up a prize. And they say, "Do you remember 12 years ago when Gary Burbank was retiring from WLW and I called in and asked if you could interview him?" Which I did 12 years ago. So I know this choice today is very, very popular. I haven't had a chance to catch up with Gary on the radio, I think, since 2012, so we're talking 7 years. That is way too long. This man is one of the most creative radio people, personalities, however you want to define it, to ever sit behind a microphone. It is always a great pleasure to welcome to these microphones, in the state of Ohio, a man who took people to work and brought them home day after day after day with a smile. The legendary creator of Earl Pitts, which is a big deal, Gary Burbank. Gary, how are you?
I'm doing fine, thanks, Scott. That was a nice intro, man. You know what? You just mentioned the amazing Kreskin.
Yes.
And about 50 years ago, he was at my apartment for this party we were having. I mean, he just kind of just walked in with a friend of his and that knew me. That just blew me away when you said the amazing Kreskin. I haven't heard that name in forever. He's great. Oh, yeah.
You know, he's a good guy, but I've told him this before because he's been on quite a few times. He's a little nutty.
Yeah.
But I like that.
Yeah, I'm not sure I do. I'm a pretty serious guy. Sometimes. Yeah, I'm trying to be in my retirement time now. I'm not. And when did I retire? Was it 10 years ago? 11 maybe.
12, getting close to 12.
I've never kept up with that kind of stuff. People would say, "Now, what was the date you came here? We'll have a celebration or something." I know it was springtime. That's all I knew.
You know, Gary, I remember when you retired, this was a very big deal to people. As I say, I got a call at the radio station at that time. When it was announced, people were shocked that you were leaving. You were a young man. Why did you decide to leave?
Actually, I wasn't a young man. I'm not one. I'm even less young today. I'm 78. I'm 78 now. When I retired, I was 66, I think. And I had planned on retiring by 29. So I was a little late.
So overshot the runway a little bit.
Yeah, somewhat. I had been, I think I made it to the 10th grade. My mother used to say if they had known what ADHD was when you were a kid, you'd have been the poster child. And I just couldn't handle school. And by the 10th grade, my sister, who was 2 years younger than me, caught up with me. And I just wasn't having that. So I quit and I joined the Army.
Oh, really?
And that was kind of a strange story. I'd, I went in the I went in and they asked me, and even then I had kind of, you know, been listening to radio announcers and disc jockeys and things, and thought to myself, I'd like to be in radio. So when the recruiting sergeant, he told me, he said, well, what would you like to do? I said, well, I would like to be with Armed Forces Network. Is there a way I could possibly do that? He goes, absolutely. You want to be a disc jockey? I said, yeah. He said, well, sign right there where it says regular Army. And I did. And truth was, I was in Fort Jackson, South Carolina. The bus picked us up there to take us to Fort Jackson. And they had been so nice the whole time. I mean, I thought, I like this Army. Everybody's very cordial and kind. And all of a sudden, they stopped, and this big, tall sergeant gets on. He's screaming, you bunch of low-life maggots, this is what we get to work with. And I was at the very back of the bus, and I'm thinking, man, I feel sorry for these guys. So he was bodily throwing people off of the bus. There's about six or seven of us, and I was the last guy. And he walked up to me, and he said, what's your story? And I said, this is not my stop. I'm going to be a disc jockey. And he was a pretty creative guy, because this was like about 10 or 11 o'clock at night. And by the time we got to our company area, he told me, if you're going to be a disc jockey, here, take this rake and make some radio waves underneath the barracks there. They were raised, you know. And I spent like an hour before he let me go to bed.
What did the Army do for you? Did you take things away from that have kept you throughout your life?
Yeah, I learned to be Beetle Bailey. I was not, you know, I went in. I always kid around saying I went in an E1 and came out an E. But I made it 3 years, and I was in Germany. And to be honest, I've never really thought about that, because I was not, like I said, I was there. I did what I was supposed to do. Nothing, you know, it was in peacetime. And I was okay. But, you know, when I took away, I learned how to shine shoes. And so then when I got out, all I wore was tennis shoes, so I didn't need that.
How did you finally break into the world of radio?
That's neat. I was, when I was a kid, as I told you, I used to think about it. I'd hear George Klein, DJ GK, on the radio, rhyming everything. Thought he was just great, and I said, okay, I want to be like that. And so we used to go, myself and about four of my friends, we used to go to something called Junior Achievement in Memphis. And right down the street from that was a radio school called Keegan's Technical Institute. And I would go, and I wouldn't go to Junior Achievement. I'd just stand there watching. They had a showcase, like, window there. You could see the guy. He wasn't really on the air because it wasn't a radio station, but he was doing a radio show, learning. And I just used to stand there mesmerized watching these guys do this thing. And then time went on. Went in the Army, became a musician. I was playing, I think I was one of the 375 original marquees. Excuse me. And I worked, we were on the road all the time, you know, playing and stuff like that. And not making a lot of money. I got married, had a son, my son Sean. And then when, that was a weird thing, it's like, okay, I'm standing there one day, and the phone rings, pick it up, and I'm realizing, I'm thinking about what I've got to do to take care of my family. And so it was my friend Charlie Freeman, who was the Red Man. He had those friend Rolling Stone when he passed away. But Charlie had Gary, well, he said Billy, because that's my real name. But he said, Gary, he said, I need for you to come get me out of jail. I said, oh, you do? He goes, yeah. He said, how much, man? He goes, $52. And I thought about it, and I had a check. I'd done a session somewhere, I probably 2 or 3 months before then, but they had just sent me my check for the session, and it was $52 exactly. So I thought, well, I'll never see this again. And it just made me think, I've got to get into something a little more legitimate than you know, playing gigs, you know, in and out of town all the time. And that's when I went to Keegan's Technical Institute, and a great newsman by the name of Bill Trotter, another guy named Tice Turway were the teachers, and they both took me under their wing, and they really worked with me, and I had a lot of work to be done. I was forcing my voice down like this all the time, and they just didn't sound that great. But I did get a job in Lake Providence, Louisiana. My first job, 250 watts. I think it was directional straight up. You could only pick it up an airplane. But I worked there for about 6 months. It's kind of the first day on the air was a little strange. I went there and I learned how to work the board. What I mean by that is the controls and all that. Overnight, you know, and so musicians go to bed, you know, late, like 2-3 o'clock in the morning, and I did that the night. I tried to go to sleep early, but I didn't quite make it, and I was up. I think I went to sleep at about maybe 3, woke up at about 5, went to the radio station, got there, got all set to go because it was a daytimer, so we were signing on. Nobody's there. So I got all ready to sign on, and I did. And I did a newscast. Talking like this in the news today. I did my newscast, and then they have a little jingle, KLPL, Lake Providence, boom. I hit my first record just right. And I think it was something by Andy Williams. I'm not sure exactly what it was, but it was the records playing. And then I promptly went to sleep sitting in the chair. My very first time on the air, I woke up about 20 or 30 minutes later, and the record's going, shh, you know, it's playing on a turntable. So the needle is on the record, and it's just going, shuk, shuk, shuk. It did that for all that time. Anybody that tuned in, that's all they heard. And I was mortified. So I tried to catch up on my commercials, and I was able to do that in the next, like, 45 minutes. I caught up on all the commercials I was supposed to play. And then everybody came into work about 8 or 9, and no one ever said a word. And I realized, there's no one listening to this radio station at this time in the morning. So I started doing characters, something I had never actually done before. I wasn't necessarily a funny guy, you know, but I was just having a great time. I was, you know, doing—I can't remember exactly, you know, what—but I, you know, I was. If I had to do a farm news, then I would go into my farm news character and say a different name, and people would think it was a different person. I think they thought that if they ever heard the radio station.
You know what's interesting?
But that was my first day on the air.
Well, what's interesting about that is that in this area, Earl Pitts has been playing for a long time, well over 30 years, every day in this particular area. And
I think it's 35 that we were just talking the other day about how it may be the longest running comedy syndication ever in radio, but nobody wants to admit it.
well, I think that's right. And the interesting thing is that when we posted that you were going to be on the show, we got some feedback about they thought Earl Pitts was a real person. This character, a lot of people believe that. Do you get that a lot?
Excuse me, I have a little cold here. Didn't mean to cough in your face. It just jumped up on me. About Earl being a real person.
Being a real person.
Well, he is kind of a real person. He exemplifies a lot of... I grew up in Memphis and Mississippi, and I used to kid around saying Memphis, the capital of Mississippi, but that's northern Mississippi mostly. And I, and Earl is a combination of some of those characters. He doesn't sound like my dad sounded, but my dad would say a lot of things that Earl said just for effect to, you know, maybe wake you up. And so that's how, you know, that's how I first started. You know what makes me sick? And Dad would say stuff like that. If I was home visiting or something, and Dad would be the first one up in the morning, and he's sitting there at the table with a cup of coffee, I'd walk in. That's where I got there. He goes, you know, it makes me sick. And I just thought that was just funny every time he just said that. And then he would, you know, go into something like, oh, just drop my pants, sit on a block of cheese and swallow a rat. And just some weird, crazy thing. And I would say, let me get a pencil. I'd write that stuff down. But he was a very funny guy when he wanted to be.
The longest-running comedy radio syndicated program, out of all the characters you've done and have done so many over the years, why is that the one? What is it about?
I don't know. It's what I would think. It's not really what I'd like for a legacy, because so many people actually believe Earl, and I have a hard time sometimes saying, well, it's a bit satirical, not always, but Earl was like a Southern, All in the Family, and Carol O'Connor played Archie, of course, and Earl is sort of like a Southern Archie, and I give you an example of what I mean by that. I'm not really saying that. Earl, you may agree with Earl when you're hearing Earl, but he's got a whacked way of getting to that point that he's making. And that's the funny thing. You've thought about, like, well, you know, maybe I shouldn't be feeling this way if this idiot does. But I remember one time I'm on the air, and I think it was LW, and I got a call. I talked to Earl, did something about the Catholic Church, and I got a call from a priest in West Virginia, and I put him on, and we started talking about, you know, he said, I don't like what you said because so-and-so. And I said, well, listen, I didn't say it. Earl said it. He goes, yeah, but you're Earl. I said, no, I'm not. I'm Gary. He said, yeah, but you do Earl Pitts. And I said, well, did you ever write Carol O'Connor of All in the Family and tell him you didn't like something he said? He goes, well, no. I said, why not? He goes, well, he's an actor. And I said, duh. And that's what I'm doing. And it was really hard to convince people that, you know, sometimes.
Well, it's interesting because how do the ideas come about? When you come together to come up with these segments for Earl Pitts, where do they come from?
Well, a lot of it's, you know, real life stuff, and I've got about five or six guys and a couple of girls that write, you know, some of this stuff. You know, and I was so lucky to have attracted some of these people. People think that I came up with all of that. I didn't. They were like comedy writers, but they couldn't move to L.A. because they were like Jim Probasco is a band director in Dayton. You know, he at the school there, and but he was a closet comedy writer. Bill Brahas, same way. John Bunyan, these guys and girls, Mary Thomas Watts, they all could write great comedy. In fact, a friend of mine was one of the head writers at MASH, and he said, "You guys, you could take that cadre of people that write with you, and you guys came. If you came to Hollywood, you'd definitely get work." He said, "You guys are great," and this guy, you know, really knows his stuff. And I was lucky enough to have them. And of course, I did, you know, edit and I did add lines, maybe take some things out and stuff like that. And then I would write some of my own stuff too. But it was a combined effort. And Doc Wolf, who was my co-host, we worked together 20 years, never had a crossword. And because of him, he was just a great writer, great. Just a great person, actually, altogether, and just that combination of people just really clicked.
Because other people write for this character, has there ever been something that came in front of you that you said, "I'm not going to do that one"?
Oh yeah, I forgot to mention Tim Mizak is the guy that really has written most of all of the Earls and things. Mizak runs our little syndication thing too. It's nothing huge, you know, and so there have been times people send me things and I wouldn't do it. Well, usually it's only if it's not funny. I'll take either side, you know, in the argument. It doesn't matter. I mean, if it's funny and it's satirical and it makes a point, I'll take it. You know, I may not agree with it, but if it's funny, then why not do it? Mm. It's like a political cartoon. You know, most political cartoonists, I think, are one way or the other, left or right, I needed more material than just one piece a day. So I couldn't just choose which side I was on, because I wouldn't be able to finish the show.
Did the voice come from your father as well?
Say again?
Did the voice come from your father, Earl's voice pattern?
Not really. It changed, actually. When I first started doing Earl, you know, Earl Pitt, he would talk like this here. Let me just tell you this. And as I did it, and he gradually became more, you know, more of, instead of being some, you know, I don't know, I don't know the right word. I'm not going to use the one I want to use. Let's see. Anyway, he became more middle of the road as far as speech. He became a guy talk like this after a while, just a plain old redneck, you know. And but
before he was more like this.
How are the shows taped these days, now that you're not doing a regular radio show?
I'm sorry, I'm having a little trouble. Oh,
okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah. How are the shows done today? How many do you tape at a time?
I do about five or six a week, and that way, on a week that I've got something left over, on a week that I just don't feel very creative and don't do a very good job, and that happens more now, and then I've got stuff that we can go to. And yeah, it's usually about four or five a week. I live in near Ocala, Florida, and I've got a little studio that, you know, it's nothing major, just a little studio, nothing like the palatial estate you're in right now, and it's just a little bitty place. And so I go out and cut stuff, and I'll play it for friends here sometimes, and they even have them laugh every now and then.
I can believe it. You mentioned earlier on your real name is not Gary Burbank. How did you get to Gary Burbank?
That's great. I was working in Memphis. I had made my way to WMPS, and my real name is William Purser. I hate to tell you, but Bill Trotter, the man I mentioned earlier, the newsman at the school, he gave me the name Johnny Apollo. Johnny Apollo, your blue-eyed soul brother in the front row. Put a little slide, you glide, dip, and you hip, bump, and you rump. Bless my right on rock and roll soul. And I was doing that kind of thing. But I'd kind of gotten past that. A guy by the name of Bob Todd, who worked at WAKY in Louisville, which was pretty much a renowned station at the time, and I didn't think I was good enough for it. I did stuff at MPS, like, you know, like my name was Purser. You know, Bill Purser. There was an orchestra leader, Bill Purcell. You remember that guy? Our Winter Love or something like that. It was just orchestral music, and it's beautiful and all that. I remember playing one morning and coming out of the record and explaining, now that's Bill Purser. Some of you may remember him from Messick High School here in Memphis. And a few people were listening, evidently. And because I've had people say, I thought you were an orchestra leader in Nashville. And I go, no, that was actually me telling you I was that. And I wasn't. Just trying to make myself bigger. And what was the question?
How did we get to Gary Burbank?
Yeah. And so, Bob Todd wanted to hire me to do afternoons at WAKY. And I was very flattered, but I just didn't know if I could do that. But I met with him and a guy by the name of Dude Walker, who is just a wonderful radio personality and TV star in Memphis. And but he was working at Wacky at the time too. And I went over to their hotel room and we talked about, you know, the station and all of that. And he said, you know, you sound like Gary Owens. And Gary Owens was on Laugh-In, and he sounded kind of like, this is Gary Owens, and I could do him to a T just about. And he said, what we ought to do is, I mean, you're Gary, you know, you could be Gary, he's Gary Owens of beautiful downtown Burbank. You could be Gary Burbank of beautiful downtown Louisville. And so, yeah, that's great. I would do anything. And I did. And I went on the air as Gary Burbank of beautiful downtown Louisville. Here's the funny part. They used to delay. The TV station that ran Laugh-In, they would delay it till Saturday night, from Tuesday to Saturday. My mother would audio tape the show off the TV, just, you know, with a little Wallen sack or something, and send me the tape reel. I would get their material off of that, and then I would do most of their comedy, but a lot of their material on Friday, and then they would hear it on Laugh-In the next day and think, well, he must be the same guy, because I heard him say that, you know, yesterday on the air on Wacky, and that was pretty weird, but yeah, that's what I was doing.
No, it's very interesting, and I have read your last morning on WAKY 1973 that you pulled this very interesting prank. How did the last show on WAKY go?
Well, okay, well, it was afternoons when I was working. My comedy with it, that's when they kind of figured that out. I mean, I did mornings at CKLW and mornings at some other stations, too. But my comedy worked better in the afternoon because it was a little weird sometimes. And now say the question again so I can formulate this in my mind. I'm 78. I forget what I'm talking about half the time.
The last show on WAKY.
Yeah, okay. That was, I decided that, you know, instead of just saying, it's been great, folks, and da-da-da-da, and then leave, I decided to be shot on the air and by an irate listener. And we built it up, and we even called the police and said, we're going to do this. And they said, we had a big showcase control room. You could see the radio personality, you know, from the street driving by. And they said, what if somebody comes by there and a salesman stops by the control room window and it looks like he's got a gun, somebody might shoot him from out there. So we had to shut the curtains and announce that this was fiction every 10 minutes, something like that. And we did, but people just don't hear that. It's sort of like Orson Welles. You know, they just don't hear it. And so I had this... You know, I was talking about it on the air, about this guy says he's going to come down here and blow me away or whatever, blah, blah, blah. And so over the course of a couple of hours, you know, it got to sounding very real. And sure enough, you know, I had the effect come up. The guy runs in. I'm doing the other guy's voice. And, you know, like, Burbank, I've always hated you. And yeah, but let me tell you, hey, what are you doing with a gun? Boom, boom. And that was it. And then I remember, I think I was playing a song by Steeler's Wheel, Stuck in the Middle with You is what I think it was. And so the record, you know, just starts playing. And at that point, this Jarl Mohn is his name. He runs, I think he still runs NPR. And he was Lee Masters then. And he, see, we all have different names and stuff. But he runs in. And he takes me in his arms, and as I die, you know, we've got the music in the background. Anybody's got to know by now this is not real. But there's music in the background, and I'm saying, like, you know, it's going to be up to you, Lee. You're going to have to step in and fill my shoes. And Lee Masters looks up, and he says, I've always wanted to do afternoon drive. Gary, he's gone. And so I died on the air, and that's how I went out. And it, you know, I think a couple of guys have done that since then.
It's a great story, and it makes me think about your days at WLW. You were doing a great comedy show, a lot of great characters on that program. How did you prepare to do a show 5 days a week?
Well, Doc and I were, you know, most guys, you know, that come in for a radio show these days, I think they come in, you know, they I'm sure they do some, you know, preparation and stuff. Undoubtedly they do. I don't think anybody ever did as much as we did. We were in there. I was up at 7 o'clock in the morning writing, sitting at the kitchen table because I didn't have an office. So I'd just be sitting at the kitchen table writing, and, you know, and Carol would come in and she would start talking to me, and I'd just, you know, it was irritating me because I'm trying to write. And, anyway, we would start early. He would write at home early in the morning, And then we would meet at the station at like 10 o'clock. We had to be on the air at 3. And so we spent all that time. And then, you know, the other guys, like, you know, the people that I mentioned, some of them, Mizak and everybody, they would write stuff. And by the time I got there, we'd have, you know, 6 or 7 pieces, you know. And some of them needed help being funny. Some of them didn't need any help being funny. So we would go over it, and then we would record, you know, the parts that we needed to, you know, to record. Like when I did Eunice and Bernice, the Siamese twins joined together at the telephone. You know, I'd do one voice, and I'll give you an example. There was a lady that used to call me on the air. I was at WHAS in Louisville, and I was there for about 4 or 5 years. And this lady, Fern Stone was her name, wonderful lady. She'd call me on the air, and she'd just talk like this, and she'd go on, and one day she called, and you could tell she'd been into the sauce a little bit. She admitted it later on. And her friend was on the extension, so they're both on the telephone, and they both talked at the same time at times. And so I just thought it sounded really funny that day. And, of course, I didn't tell her anything. The next day, I came in, same thing there. When I worked there, I came in early, and I recorded her, a voice, you know, kind of like hers, an older lady's, you know, voice. And then I did a harmony part over that voice, you know, like the two ladies. This is Eunice. They'd always think they were calling Rush Limbaugh. Rush! I go, this is not Rush. You know, we always say Rush. A day without Rush Limbaugh is like a day without, you know, a spoonful of soup shoved up your nose or just something, you know. And people just thought that was pretty funny. And so that the first time I did it was the day after she and the other lady had been on the phone, both of them, you know, drinking a little too much and a little too much wine, I think. And so I did it. I thought it was a pretty funny piece. I did it, and then I get a phone call, of course, you know. This is off the air, and she said, "You think I don't know, you know, what you're doing there?" I said, "Fern, I hope you're not upset with me." She said, "Nah, it was funnier than hell." She was just great.
That's a great story. Over the years, you did so many great characters on WLW, repeat characters. Do you have a favorite?
Yeah, I probably do. Boy, I can't tell you the story. There's not enough on this one, but excuse me. My favorite character was probably Howlin' Blind Muddy Slim, your 60-minute Jelly Belly Toe Jam Man, where I got to play guitar, and Howlin' Blind would come up with all these ridiculous things and everything, and that really came from when I was a drummer. I played, you remember Jimmy Reed by any chance?
Yes, yes.
You know, the song, Big Boss Man, can't you hear me when I call? So I was playing with Jimmy Reed at a big place in Memphis, and I'd never met him before. I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to tell you this story. I'll work around it here. So, okay, I'm sent over by, there's a, you know, the agents and stuff, a drummer and a bass player. I was with the bass player. We had never played with him, but it didn't matter because, you know, we can play his stuff. So I'm waiting. We're going to do a sound check, and it's about, I guess, 5 or 6 o'clock in the afternoon, and this big Cadillac pulls up, and the manager gets out, and then Jimmy gets out. I remember he's wearing this white suit. And he just, when he got out, he was just reeling, kind of holding onto the car so it would hold him up, you know, and he didn't look like he was in, you know, perfect shape. And the manager walked up to me and he said, let me tell you something. He said, don't give him anything to drink. And I said, I think you're too late. And he said, nah, man, that's just residual. I said, okay. So we go in, and I go sit behind the drums, and he's plugging in. His son was playing the gig, too. His son was playing another guitar, and Junior. And so we're getting all set up for a sound check, and he, you know, plays a little bit, and he walks back to me, and he said, you the drummer? And I said, yes, sir. And I'm sitting behind the drums. He said, and he put his hand reached all the way across my snare. I remember him, they were really long fingers. He reached across and he touched me. He said, you can hit this? I said, okay. And then he put his hand on my hi-hat, said, you can hit on that? Yeah. Hand on my bass drum, said, and you can kick that? Yeah. If you hit any one of these other drums, I'm going to bust you upside your blankety-blankety-blankety-blankety head with this blankety-blankety guitar. And I said, yes, sir. So, you know, all night long, it's like, doom, 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 bam, doom, bam. And if I decided that I wanted to, you know, I just was going to kick him in. I knew when the vocals started, so I'd go, boom, bam, boom, ba-tap, bam, bam, ba-tap, you know. Man, he whirled around on stage and just glared at me and kind of looked at the guitar like he was about to smack me with it. And I said, oh, I'm sorry. And that was the last time I did anything except go bap, doom, bap, bap. That's it. And so to make a long story longer, we finished the gig, and it went pretty well. So we finished the gig. And I was waiting around to get paid. That's what musicians do usually after a gig. The club owner usually likes to keep the money as long as he can. And so I'm waiting. And Jimmy just disappeared. Now, this was a place that, sold a lot of whiskey and stuff. And so we couldn't find him. And everybody then became like, we got to find Jimmy. So we're going all over the place. There's nobody, left in the place, extended. So I was lucky enough to be the one who found him. At a table toward the back, I remember red checkered tablecloths. I lifted a tablecloth up, and there he was. And this was kind of against the wall, the table was. And he was laying in the floor, and he had all these drinks that he had gotten off the table. And what's left in the drinks is something that we referred to as spiders. And he was, he was just about out. He was incoherent, going, I'm pointing to me. And I just kind of stood there. And about that time, the bass player walked up, and we both looked at him, and I said, someday, that'll be us. And he said, we can only dream, can't we, about becoming big stars and able to do that. And that's my Jimmy Reed story. So I based that character on that night, and Howlin' Blind's is that guy.
That is a great story. Great story. When you were on the air, 1980s, 90s. We saw the proliferation into radio because you wrote your shows and they were comedy pieces of zoo programs, Howard Stern, Don Imus. What did you make of that type of radio coming in?
And Don Imus?
Don Imus, Howard Stern, zoo programs.
Yeah, some of those guys. Yeah. It was a different kind of thing. And I'm not sure how to address it. I was more in Ernie Kovacs, Jonathan Winters. They were all my heroes. And can you hold on 1 second?
Yeah, go right ahead. We're chatting with the legendary Gary Burbank.
Cold.
Oh, no problem.
I know who gave it to me, too, is my neighbor. Next time I get sick, I'm going to run over there and breathe all over him.
That type of radio, what did you make of it?
I didn't really think of it as anything, actually. It just wasn't what I did. It was effective. There's no two ways about that. I know, as we call them, angry white guys, but I think Stern's a great interviewer. I mean, you listen to him; he does some really good stuff. Gosh, I got to get over this thing. I thought I was going to be over today. So yeah, Gary came on my show this morning and just coughed into my phone. But anyway. What did I think of them? I liked them okay. I didn't listen much to it because it was a different. It would be like a Monty Python fan watching. I started to say the Three Stooges, but heck, I love the Three Stooges. It'd be like a Monty Python fan laughing at you know, Phyllis Diller or something, you know, although she was funny. But I wouldn't say that it was my favorite kind of radio. Of course, that became even more serious when suddenly the political opinions were being expressed by these guys. You know, people picked up on it and they realized that you know, I'm more of I don't have to be funny. I can be, you know, I can talk politics, and they did. And they became, you know, talk show hosts. But I know they're disc jockeys, and I'm a disc jockey. And when a disc jockey tells me something, I'm not necessarily going to believe he's telling me the truth, and then he really believes it. But I mean that as a joke. I got along with all of them, you know, it was fine, but I just did a different kind of, you know, I think it was Mike Kanosian who written an article when I was leaving, saying I was the last dinosaur, and I think he was right. I haven't heard that since, and but it's just, you know, how ratings work in radio, and you know this. It's sort of like, I'm not talking Imus and Stern now. I'm talking, you know, as things, you know, perpetuated themselves, and when, you know, like Sean Hannity has big numbers, you know, big ratings. I remember one time he beat me, and he had never done that in a book in my hometown in a rating period, when the program director said, you had 12 to 1 more listeners than he did. However, your listeners only listen on the way home from, you know, from work or whatever. They average like 20 minutes to 30 minutes, whereas a talk show like that, and people, I guess, are looking for something to back up their feelings about things, and they're maybe more into it. And they would stay there for, you know, much longer, and so therefore, you know, the longer you stay, the bigger the ratings are. But then the next book came out, and I kicked his butt, so everything's fine.
There you go. It all turned out okay. In the last few minutes we have, Gary, I wanted to ask you, because your show was scripted in a different type of radio, is there a show that sticks out in your mind that you would say, boy, this is the one I want to put in the time capsule? That was a perfect show.
No. There was, with me, it's funny, because with me, I don't think, Scott, I was ever really satisfied with the show, and that's not good. I mean, you know, they're talking to me now about podcasting some of the old stuff, and I didn't realize I had this much, plus I thought it was on tape, and I wasn't about to try to get this stuff off on tape and on the digital, because I don't really understand digital yet. And so I didn't really think too much about, you know, what I did. I just didn't listen to it because we were too busy doing something for the next day. And I'd hear it. Yeah, sure. I could hear, you know, some of the stuff sometime and laugh. But most of the time when I heard any of my stuff coming back at me, I would criticize myself. You know, I should have done this here, or I should have done that there. And so what happens is, you know, you don't really enjoy listening to yourself very much. We were syndicated on Westwood One for quite a while. And I know Carol and I'd be driving somewhere on Saturday night, and we'd hear, you know, me, and I'd listen about 2 minutes and turn it off. However, when they started talking about the podcasting, my daughter wants to produce it. She's a producer TV, and a college professor. So she wants to do it, so I'm thinking about doing it. And then I had to sit with a couple of friends and listen to some stuff and see how it would sound and how it would work. It sounded, I mean, I hate to say this, but it sounded great. I mean, and I was thinking, this stuff is, they were laughing, and I'm saying, this stuff really is funny. And so, who knows, I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to do it, but it turns out that someone, my producer on the air at LW, had actually put this stuff on a hard drive. So as soon as I can figure out how to work a hard drive, I'll listen to the rest of it and maybe do it someday.
I know a lot of people would be very happy with that. Gary, before we wrap up here, one time you mentioned Carol O'Connor earlier on and his relationship with Archie Bunker and Earl Pitts and that relationship. I heard Carol O'Connor asked one time if it bothered him, because Carol was a multifaceted actor, that first and foremost, he was going to be remembered as Archie Bunker. You did so much. You do so much. You have so many more characters. But when you go 50 years from now, it will say, voice of Earl Pitts, I imagine, dives. Does that
or
bother
Gilbert
you?
Gilbert Gnarly. I get a lot of Gilbert, too.
Gilbert Gnarly, yeah, absolutely.
He's one of my favorites, too.
What, does it bother you that you're so closely associated with Earl Pitts?
Not really. Not really. I mean, Earl helped pay some bills, and so, that's all right. But, like, not really. Because I think Earl was, I know what I meant by doing Earl. I know I was doing, you know, a little satire. And so, it's just when someone, I think, that thinks that's the only thing that I did, I'd like to say, no, there are others, like Gilbert. I mean, I'd call the White House so many times. Well, one of the things I used to call the White House about, remember Gilbert always wanted to sell them aluminum siding. Sir, this is the White House. Yes, but this will make me a star in the aluminum siding business. And it was some pretty funny stuff.
It absolutely was. And Gary, we just scratched the surface this morning, so I do hope it's not 7 years and you'll come back with us from time to time, because these stories are fun to listen to. People miss you. You're a gigantically popular choice to have on this morning, so I really do hope you come back with us.
Well, Scott, thank you very much for remembering me, and I'm still here, but for a limited time only. Let's not wait 7 years. I have COPD. I got to be cool.
Thank you, Gary.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Bye-bye.
Okay.
Legendary Gary Burbank. You can't go wrong there. Back in about 10 minutes.
And comes back and does the work we need.
And on being vice president.
Interesting. Before I let you go, Senator Brown, and I